Well, what I'm going to talk about is the interactions between spherical macro ions in dilute electrolytes and dilute simple electrolytes at that. The most important part of the work, naturally, is the people who did it. And in particular, I'm going to be talking about the work done by some recent graduates from my group, Jessica Weiss, John Crocker, and Amy Larson. If time permits, I'll also tell you about some new results by Pam Korda and Eric Dufresne. What I'll be telling you about is ways to measure interactions between these polystyrene lattices that show up all over the place these days. The spheres themselves are micron diameter, that scale. I'll tell you what the particular diameters are for the particular spheres when I come to them. They have sulfonate head groups chemically bound to their surfaces. These ionizable groups, dissociatable groups, dissociate when you put them in water, leaving negative surface charges bound to the surface and positive counterions floating in solution. In addition to those counterions, there is additional salt in solution. We try to minimize the concentration of the additional salt by ion exchange. So typically, you should think of ionic strengths around 10 to the minus 6 molar, not physiological, somewhat lower than that. So the interactions between the particles you should expect to be long range. So these are large particles, micron scale, separated by large distances on the order of microns. The scale for their interaction forces is measured typically in hundreds of...
Could we have it brighter again? Could we have it a little brighter? The last stage is better.
Right. So the typical scale for the forces is measured... it goes down to hundreds of femtonewtons and rises at most to, say, a nanonewton. These are pretty small forces. And naturally, we've heard a lot in the last couple of days about the results of describing such a system with the nonlinear Poisson-Boltzmann equation, linearizing the Poisson-Boltzmann equation, then, where's my enormous stick? Here's my enormous stick. Then superposing the results for two spheres under the assumption that the presence of a neighboring sphere doesn't disrupt the ion cloud around the first sphere. So there are three approximations that immediately leap to mind: the use of the Poisson-Boltzmann formalism, linearization, and linear superposition. If you do that, you end up with a pair potential that looks like this. There's a screen Coulomb potential with a term that accounts for the exclusion of the simple ions from the macro ions cores. There's also van der Waals attraction. And I'm not going to be telling you anything about van der Waals attraction. And the reason is, for polystyrene spheres separated by more than 100 nanometers of water, the absolute magnitude of van der Waals attraction is less than 1/100th of a kT at room temperature. And for spheres separated by a micron, it's more like a thousandth of a kT, and is therefore unmeasurably small, at least it is for us. So a cartoon of the DLVO potential has, in fact, a van der Waals secondary minimum at some separation, but that's going to be too small for us to see. So you should think of the effective pair potential as being a purely repulsive screen Coulomb interaction. So the question is this the case? If you actually measure the interactions between these spheres, is this what you see? And to sort of load... Certainly can. Oh, that's the contact attraction. When the spheres come into contact, van der Waals attractions win, and you're never going to get the spheres apart.
That's what you're calling the van der Waals primary minimum.
That's what van der Waals is and arises because the van der Waals attraction is long range, but the prefactor is small. So it's at this distance, it's negligibly weak. So why would anyone think that this is not the case? And a lot of people in the room know why, but I'll sure flash up one picture. Here are micron diameter polystyrene sulfonate spheres in water at about 10 to the minus 6 molar total salt. And in the middle of this nice suspension, you can see there's a void. This is actually a monolayer of spheres sandwiched between glass. I'll tell you more about that in a bit. But this is an optical slice through a three-dimensional suspension. And you can see there's a big hole in the suspension. These have been reported by other groups. We've never published this for a reason that I hope they'll have the chance to tell you about. The question you might ask is, why doesn't this sphere pop into the hole? What's keeping it out? These holes persist for a very long time. And a cautious person would say, maybe there's some schmutz in the hole that we can't see, and that's what's keeping the spheres out. A more brave, courageous person might say, it's because the spheres don't repel each other, they're actually attracted to each other. They have a preferred separation. And that's a bold statement, and insults tend to be heaped upon people who make such statements. So the question is there a direct way to measure the interactions between these spheres? And the answer is absolutely yes. If you know the paracorrelation function for the separation between two spheres in the limit of infinite dilution, that's simply related through the Boltzmann distribution to the parapotential. So I'm going to show you a quick video of some data that Mauricio, well, I may show you, if the thing comes on, that Mauricio Carbajal from San Luis Potosi gave me. Are we on? Of course not, because we were unplugged. To hell with it. If I didn't need the transparencies, I certainly didn't need them.
Ah,
there you go. Fantastic.
Turn this one off, and then we'll give you a better.
We'll rewind a little. That's a big guy. These are small guys. These are small guys going backwards.
Not time reversible.
It is time reversible. Those are phonons. these are micron diameter polystyrene spheres, again between parallel glass walls, undergoing Brownian motion. If you take many, many hours of videotape like this, you can come up with a paracorrelation function for the separation between these spheres. And you can drop your microphone. I hate my microphone. I'm going to leave my microphone.
You'll have your footsteps.
Well, I won't be on the web, but you'll still be able to hear me. So here's the experiment. You've got spheres in a monolayer. Trapped between glass walls. The glass has a charge which is comparable in magnitude to the surface charge density on the sphere. You take zillions of these pictures, build them up, you get a paracorrelation function, which is related to the pair interaction potential, and there is a problem. If you do this recipe, you come out with an attractive minimum in the parapotential measured this way. And this was first done, by Greg Kepler and Seth Braden in 1994. Jose Luis Arizara's group did the analysis in a more convincing way and came out with the same result a couple years later. And the result is that, as far as this experiment says, these spheres don't simply repel each other but have a preferred separation. Now, the question is that intrinsic?
Sorry to answer a silly question. Quite sure. D is the diameter. So this preferred separation is about 3.5 diameters of this picture.
That's right, several microns. Several being 2 or 3.
What's the
spacing between the glass walls and these experiments was something like 10 microns. Again, that we'll come back to that in a little bit.
So this is a projective
gear bar. This is a two-dimensional gear bar, which is another thing that you ought to be careful about. But can handle properly. So the question, though, is this attraction an intrinsic property of the spheres? Is it something special about the spheres between the glass walls? Is it something that the glass walls are doing? And I won't go into all the details, but the answer is, yes, it is something that the glass walls are doing. And yes, it's something that's intrinsic to the spheres. And I will try to make that case for you now. Now, the way we can probe the interactions between these spheres is to put them in a very clean chemical environment made by hermetically sealing a cover slip to a slide with access tubes allowing us access to the volume between the cover slip and the slide. This is a cross-sectional view. The whole thing's hermetically sealed against invasion by carbon dioxide, which would tend to acidify the water. We keep ion exchange resin in these access tubes to scrub away sodium ions leaching from the glass, for example. and any carbon dioxide that actually does make its way through our adhesives. The whole thing goes on through a heavily instrumented optical microscope, and what we can do with
Where is the ion exchange resin?
The ion exchange resin is in the mind's eye in these tubes. So we typically fill a few grains into each tube. A tube is typically a quarter inch. I brought a cell with me. You can take a look and see how they...
I'm worried about convective flow.
You should be, yeah. Absolutely. We worry about them too, and we've got ways to get rid of them, or at least to tell if they're there. That's the most important thing. So again, you can make images of these spheres, and it turns out that even though we're using light to image the spheres, light has a typical wavelength around 500 nanometers, you can use image processing techniques to find the centroids of each sphere's image to within 20 nanometers in the plane. That's pretty good. It's like using this to measure an inch. Only it works. So you can then hook up the sphere locations into trajectories. Here's an interesting, for me at least, picture of a crystal fluid interface. This is not simulation, this is data. Well, it's data from an experiment. It's not data from a simulation.
It's called analog simulation.
It's good. God's own simulation. So the idea is that just imaging gives you enough spatial resolution to attack the length scales for these interactions. Now the game plan would be, if I could have just two spheres in three dimensions and let them go, let them wander, their trajectories tell you about the Brownian forces, the random forces that are causing the spheres to go on their random walks, but also it contains information about the spheres' interactions. The problem is that if you have two spheres in proximity, even if they're not interacting, there are more ways to diffuse apart than there are to diffuse together, so the two spheres will go on their merry ways and you'll never see them again. So what you need is a way to manipulate the spheres, and the way we use to manipulate the spheres is optical tweezers. And the idea is you take your objective lens in your microscope, use that to bring a laser beam to a tight focus. The focus is the brightest spot in all three dimensions. That means the electric field intensity is highest at the focal spot, and dielectric particles are drawn to high electric field intensity. So a dielectric particle, like a colloidal sphere, gets stuck at the focus of the focused laser beam. If you use one laser beam to trap one particle, you can use two laser beams to trap two particles. And I can't resist showing this little video. If this doesn't work, then that's the end of videos for me for a while. Of course it doesn't work. Ah, okay, so that's a decane emulsion droplet. This guy is 10 microns in diameter. We've got an infrared laser beam trapping him. You can occasionally see the backscattered light. And you can see he's at our mercy. He's a victim.
He's being moved around.
He's being moved around with an optical tweezer. Everyone else is just undergoing Brownian motion. So that's all fine and good. If you can grab one sphere with one tweezer, you can grab 16 spheres with 16 tweezers. This is a holographically generated hexadeca tweezer. It's not perfect, so it's got some secondary minima. So we're actually grabbing 21 spheres when we're aiming for 16. That's surely worth extra grant money, if anything is. But what we're going to do is not grab 16 spheres. You can tell I love this. This is relatively new, so it's like running and running. Rather than grabbing 16 spheres, what we're going to do is grab two spheres, move them to where we want them, and then let them go. And that's what we're doing. We've got two spheres and two tweezers. Every time the laser blinks off, the spheres are free to move. And we're blinking quite rapidly, so the spheres aren't moving very much. But if you stop that, when the spheres are bright and the tweezers are on, when the spheres are dim, the tweezers are off. So this is what the raw data look like. Here the spheres, the tweezers are on, the spheres are trapped. Then in 1/30th of a second interval, the spheres are allowed to diffuse. Then we turn the tweezers on, the spheres snap back to the same place. They snap back to the same place in three dimensions. We can place them far from the walls and just let them go. The idea is the following. Same game plan, Boltzmann distribution. There's a Lonsdale equation, which has a Fokker-Planck equation associated with it. The Fokker-Planck equation has a master equation as its formal solution. And the idea is the following. If you know the probability to find two spheres separated by this much now, this gives you the probability to find them separated by that much, a little time tau, 1/30th of a second later. This thing, this propagator for the master equation, is something that we can measure. We just count. Here are two spheres separated by this much now. A 1/30th of a second later, they're separated by that much. Plot a point. They came in separated by this much, they go out separated by that much. Plot a point. Do that thousands of times. The original measurement by John Crocker was done with John putting his hand in the beam to let the spheres go and taking his hand out of the beam to let them to trap them again. There are only 20,000 data points. This is our first data set, so it stinks. It's undersampled. It's really not good for anything except demonstration. But you know, here's John 1, 2, 3, 40,000. John went out for a beer. What you do then is you bend these data points up into a probability distribution. That probability distribution is the propagator for the discretized version of the master equation. You numerically solve this master equation for its stationary solution. So if you find a probability distribution that doesn't evolve in time under this master equation, that's the equilibrium probability distribution. It's the probability distribution that doesn't evolve in time. If that's the equilibrium probability distribution, then it's for finding the spheres separated by a particular distance, then that's simply related through the Boltzmann distribution to the parapotential.
Dave?
Yes?
You don't have any hydrodynamic coupling in your Langevin equation, just Stokes' drag. Shouldn't you worry about
that? Fantastic question. Actually, ask me again toward the end when I see how far I've gone, because I can show you measurements of the hydrodynamic coupling, and which shows that at the large separations we're talking about, the hydrodynamic coupling is in fact negligibly small and doesn't. We can see the hydrodynamic coupling if we bring the spheres close enough. The spheres are far enough apart now that it's small.
And there is a long tail. I mean, there's a potentially long tail to your kernel. So
that's right.
A truncation error.
There's a definite danger of truncating. But I'll show you now that truncation is probably not a problem. So here's our first. This is bad data. I'm showing you bad data so you'll appreciate the good data later. The point is that we do, in fact, have to truncate this probability distribution. So if there's any flux of probability out of the end, we've got to fold it back. Otherwise, our eigenvalue problem doesn't have a solution. Well, it does. It's zero. So we actually do worry about normalizing to get a proper probability distribution. Conditioned, that's the word, well-conditioned matrix. So the sign that we've done this right is that, in fact, the potential that we extract does asymptote to zero. It looks like, in fact, there's no interaction, so there should be no probability flow. And we can check that by, in fact, partitioning our data into smaller sets and making sure we don't change anything. So fine. So we measure the parapotential in this way. We're using non-equilibrium data to get the equilibrium parapotential. It's the effective parapotential mediated by the small ions. And it looks like the DLVO prediction. In fact, the solid lines are fits to DLVO. But there are, as many theorists as there are in the world, there are that many theories. And so you can fit these data sets to any theory you choose. And people have. And so the problem is that with these data sets, you can't distinguish among the theories unless the functional form of the fit is awful. Because the charge for the interactions is not known a priori. You can measure the electrophoretic charge, but there's no guarantee that that will give you the interaction. You can't really know the screening length at such small ionic concentrations, because you can't be sure you really know the ionic concentrations at such low levels. All you can do is fit. And if these numbers are free parameters, I can fit it to my signature. I can fit any numbers, any theory I want. So the problem is, how do we control these control parameters? And the solution is, to put a variety of different guys all in the same ring. So we have big guys, medium-sized guys, small guys. We don't know what the ionic strength is, but we do know that everyone is in the same electrolyte, so they must have the same ionic strength. So then what we do is we use the optical tweezers to go grab a couple of victims, take them to a quiet place, and molest them. And then when we're done with them, we throw them away and take another couple of spheres and do the experiment with them too. That's the technical term for do the experiment. So repeat this over time with the different combinations of spheres. And you can tell what kind of sphere you've got because you can see them with the microscope. So whatever the ionic strength is, it had better be the same for all of the different populations. So here are some data sets. These are, the reds are bigs measured against bigs. The greens are mediums against mediums. The blues are smalls against smalls. These are fits to the DLVO theory. They are fits with 5 free parameters. Holy cow. 5 free parameters total. We've got the ionic strength when we began, the charge on the bigs, the charge on the mediums, the charge on the smalls, and then we allow ourselves also for the ionic strength to drift a little bit. So that's 5 free parameters. So a linear, we assume a linear drift. And I'll get back to that in a little bit.
The sizes we know.
The sizes we know. We did measure those ourselves to confirm the manufacturer's plans. The bottom sets are replotted so that if, in fact, the DLVO form works, the data will follow the line whose slope is the screen length. So if, in fact, these guys, the DLVO form works, all these data sets should fall on lines with the same slope, and in fact, they seem to. But wait, there's more. These are the measurements of bigs against mediums, bigs against smalls, and mediums against smalls. Something that you couldn't even imagine doing with light scattering, a heterogeneous system. The solid lines through here have no parameters. The reason they have no parameters is because we took the numbers from the earlier measurements and put them in to explain, just overlaid the curves that resulted on these data sets. The data sets are a little more ragged than the ones I showed you before because John and I were a little more ragged than we were. Because all of these experiments were done in the same stream over actually an 8-hour period. We then went back and did the first measurement again at the end to make sure we got consistent results, and we did. So fine, the DLVO theory seems to be working functionally quite well. The functional forms are quite good. The numbers we're getting out from the screening length, 200 or so nanometers, are consistent with what we think the ionic strength is. The charges on the spheres are consistent with charge regulation theories, which I'd be happy to tell you about if you asked me, but aren't germane to the main story. And you can see that, in fact, the apparent screening length is decreasing over the time that the experiment was done. That's consistent with a reduction, an increase of ionic contamination in our cell of about 10 to the minus 8 molar per hour, which turns out for our cells to be 3 ions per square nanometer per year. And that's, we're pretty happy with that. So DLVO seems to work quantitatively. It seems to work, the functional form seems to be good. It works up to superposition. The big charge is the big charge, even if you're interacting with small guys. So what's the brouhaha about like charges attracting them? And what about the experiment that I showed you that came out with this attractive minimum? Well, you can also do these pair interaction measurements as you bring the glass walls closer together. What we do is we, in fact, reduce the pressure inside the cell. The glass walls bow together. That's how we regulate the separation between the plates. And if we do so, if the walls are about 6.5 microns apart, you get a pair of potentials that looks just like DLVO. These are intended to be scale drawings. When you bring the walls down to more like 4 micron separation, the spheres are no longer free to move in the third dimension. They only move in the plane, presumably because of their electrostatic interactions with the walls.
This is based on observation.
And you can tell if the spheres move in the third dimension because their appearance changes, and that change in appearance can be calibrated.
And they're reflecting from the walls.
The walls have the same magnitude and sign of surface charge density as the spheres, measured by streaming voltammetry. So when you bring the walls closer together, the spheres become confined to the plane, and at the same time, an attractive minimum opens up in the parapotential, just like in the completely orthogonal measurements on spheres freely diffusing. If you bring the walls closer together still, the curve still has a minimum. If you bring the walls really close together, the parapotential changes form again. And this was something that Frank Stillinger talked about in the 60s. What's happening is the field lines emanating from the spheres are no longer terminating on ions in solution, but in fact you can have an unscreened interaction through the glass. And so what we think we're seeing here is the core screen Coulomb repulsion, an additional unscreened repulsion mediated by the glass, and this blip, I think, is the remnant of whatever's going on there. The minimum is about half a KTT. This is for a larger sphere. This is a minimum of about one KTT. These spheres really see each other, and the separation at this minimum is about 2 or 3 microns for micron scale spheres. So it's an enormous separation. Micron diameter spheres. That's right, the micron diameter sphere. So this is for 1.5 micron diameter sphere. This is a 1 micron diameter sphere.
And you estimated
the bi-length? Yeah, I mean, we estimate the bi-length to be on the order of 300 nanometers based on what we assume to be our base salt concentration. But that number also comes out from the fits to the DLVO potential. Now, squeezing the walls together brings in the walls' counter ions also. So God only knows what the ionic strength really is when the walls are close. But it doesn't matter because we have no explanation for the functional form of the potential either. Two walls do it, but even one wall does it. We can do this measurement by bringing the spheres to a particular separation from one wall. If the spheres are 9 microns from the wall, you get something that looks like a DLVO repulsion. If the spheres are, in this case, 3.5 microns from the wall, you get this, again, anomalous attraction. If I do something grotesque and subtract this form from this form, I get something that looks, that you could say is, it's what the attraction looks like. It's a grotesque thing to do. And so the result is just meant to be indicative. So the attraction is long-range, and I mean, if you throw a screen Coulomb form through, whatever, it looks fine. The key thing is that the form doesn't look like e to the minus kappa r over r. It looks like e to the minus 1/2 kappa r over r. And we spent some time worrying about where does half a kappa come from, and then we decided we ought to worry about where does r over 2 come from. R over 2 would come from having some excess counter ions clustered at the midpoint between the macro ions.
But there must be a distance from the wall where these particles, how far are they from the wall, because then it would be the
right
screen.
Right, the particles are about 3.5 microns from the wall. Under the conditions where you see the attraction, and about 9 microns in the wall when you don't.
Do you think that means that half they put to change the distance from the wall?
I wouldn't bet the farm on the half. As I said, this is meant to be strictly indicative, and also to sort of pollute your minds with what I think is going on.
Are the walls negative?
The walls are negatively charged, as are the spheres.
Are charges mobile, which are on the walls?
Almost definitely, yes. And actually, Sven Behrens, who is here in the audience, has actually shown charge sites appearing and disappearing. So, there's an explanation for this. It's wrong. In fact, from our observations, we can draw some conclusions already. There are theories out there which predict that isolated pairs of spheres will attract each other. So far, none of the experiments that have probed the interactions between isolated pairs of spheres have seen attractions. isolated pairs appear to repel each other just the way DLVO tells you. And that's good, because those are the conditions that DLVO were formulated for. So if isolated pairs repel each other, then theories such as the Sagani-Issei theory, which predict pairwise attraction for isolated pairs, are probably excluded by our arguments. And in fact, that particular theory, I can show you if you're interested, is in fact excluded by our measurements. The walls induce some kind of attraction through a mechanism that we don't understand. That turns out not to be predicted by the linear DLVO theory. So linear DLVO is good for isolated pairs of spheres, but for more complicated many-body systems, it seems that you run into problems. The interactions are really long-range. We're talking about microns. So ignoring the structure of the water, ignoring the structure of the solvent, is probably an okay approximation. Nanometer scale correlations probably aren't responsible for the micron scale effect that we're seeing. That's not demonstrated, but it seems a reasonable argument. There are models which suggest that spheres between pairs of walls, one could bubble up, one could bubble down, you get oppositely charged dipole moments, no right-hand rule intended, which would attract each other. But since even a single wall induces the attraction, those mechanisms don't work either. The attraction's also longer range than the repulsion. And that was the real point of that last transparency and subtracting the two potential curves. Now, there are a class of mechanisms which give you attractions that are doubly screened. So, for example, if I have a fluctuation in the distribution of ions around a around a sphere, that will induce a multipole moment, which in turn induces a sympathetic moment in the neighboring sphere, leads to an attraction. Those attractions are doubly screened. They must happen, but they're not what's responsible for this, because they're shorter range than the repulsion. Similarly, Luc Belloni has shown that if you have ions adhering to the surface of the spheres, that in itself, if you have an attraction of the ions to the spheres, can induce a doubly screened attraction also. That must happen, but it's not what we're seeing here. Is it special to the walls? Even if it were something special about the walls, that would be neat, because this might tell us something about vesicles moving in the presence of membranes and problems like that. But now I'm going to argue that it's not just germane to the walls, that it's an intrinsic part of colloidal suspension's many-body properties. And we do that in the following way. We have electrodes in our cells. It's how we do some of our measurements. And those electrodes allow us to move the spheres by electrophoresis. And what we were originally intending to do is move our spheres back and forth in the plane that we were observing by applying an electric field along this plane. Move the spheres back and forth for a variety of reasons, including washing the spheres over the ion exchange resin to clean them.
Excuse me, where are the electrodes in that picture?
The electrodes are evaporated onto one of the plates. They're gold chrome electrodes on the top surface.
I see, so they're not the normal sort of dipping
electrodes. They're not dipping electrodes, no, actually. I mean, if you want, I can show you. I have brought the cell with me so you can see how the electrodes are arranged. The idea was to move the spheres back and forth. And, you know, we're experimenters, so who moves spheres back and forth with electric fields? Don't worry about fringing fields. And what we found was something very surprising. If we drove the spheres back and forth, they did, in fact, move back and forth, but they also moved to the walls of their container. And I think I understand this effect in words, but not in equations, which is when you turn on the electric field, the spheres and all the ions are driven by electrophoresis. You end up setting up a Poisson flow between the glass plates. So now you have spheres moving in a shear flow of fluid. Spheres in a shear flow start to rotate. Rotating spheres entrain flow with them. So now you can think of a sphere in a shear flow rotating. We now apply the electrophoretic driving to that sphere and push him into his bow wake. And so he experiences a Magnus force downward, whose resultant ends up pushing you to this, the lower wall if you're below midplane and the upper wall if you're above midplane. This has nothing to do with gravity directly, because spheres go both up and down. This is handy. It was actually when we first saw it, it was a disaster. Oh no, we can't do the experiment we wanted to do. And then we realized, oh, we can do something better than we'd hoped. What we do is we take a low density suspension of spheres in a fluid phase. We apply the AC field and drive the spheres to the walls. Increasing the density drives a phase transition. The fluid distribution of spheres crystallizes. Then you turn the field off, and there's nothing holding the spheres together anymore. So they're free to go on their merry way. And you expect spheres to diffuse off the surface of these crystals and the crystals to melt. And we thought, oh, fantastic. It's an opportunity to watch melting of a superheated crystal, which is it's a very difficult thing to do in conventional condensed matter systems because it's hard to superheat real materials. And with this trick, it turns out to be dead easy to superheat colloidal crystals.
Let's see if we can actually show that.
If the video drops, then still moving. and
presto, play.
Fantastic. This is okay. If you missed it, we took our gas of spheres and compressed it. What we've done is we're driving back and forth. The spheres are still being driven. That you can't see them moving back and forth because they're driving them at 60 hertz. So their motions are phase-locked to the video camera, so they appear stationary. And they're actually moving back and forth at 60 hertz at quite frenetic rate, about one diameter total, which you can tell by detuning to 59 hertz and looking at the oscillations at a couple of 1 hertz. When we turn off the field, the field's still on, when we eventually do turn off the field, this crystal, which is hideously out of focus, will melt. And just as I said, there's nothing actually surprising about this. There it goes. You're watching.
Where is the midpoint? How thick is the plate separation in this picture?
Fantastic questions. We are looking at a plane 3 microns from the glass wall. The cell itself is 25 microns thick. The initial volume fraction was something like 0.2%. of 1 micron diameter spheres. And so the crystal has just melted, as promised, back to its equilibrium fluid state. And there are interesting things you can take from this picture, but we're not going to. It's not the start of the show.
Well, where is this empty place where they should go?
We can't see it, because what we've done is taken guys from the middle and pushed them to the walls, and we're looking at everyone pushed against the wall. And then they move from the walls into the vault. And here's the experiment that I want you to see, that I want you to focus on. So now we've reduced the ionic strength by washing the suspension over ion exchange resin. This whole experiment is also temperature regulated to within a tenth of a degree. We're going to apply the electric field in the plane. The spheres will be moving back and forth, but we won't see it. They'll end up being pressed against the wall. Here comes, now the field's on. The spheres are moving toward the wall. There is no theory for this effect, as far as I know. No real theory, just the words I gave you.
What happens when you change the frequency?
It doesn't work. There's a band of frequencies over which it works. The right frequency appears to depend on the sphere's size, on the dimensions of the cell, the gap thickness. There are actually a whole slew of experimental parameters. So many, in fact, that we weren't able to do a systematic study. We didn't know where to go. We didn't have a theory to follow.
Have you been sampling the literature on blood flow where cells tend to go?
Yes, and actually there's a long literature starting, I guess, with Happel and Brenner, who not their book, but their publications, which describe flows under a force and shear flow. And you end up with the wrong sign of the effect. The spheres are supposed to go to the middle. You're anticipating me. The question is, what is the effect of the Debye length? And I'll tell you that at some point the field's going to be turned off. I think the field's actually off now. And what you're looking at, the dark guys are closest to you. The bright guys are in the next plane of an SCC crystal. You might see sort of dim bright smudges in the next plane. That's the third layer. The spheres are separated by about 3 microns, so these enormous separations. It's an SCC crystal. You can see the first plane, the second plane, the third plane behind that. The fourth plane is behind the first plane. And in some places, the crystal is up to 7 layers thick. The field is off. And nothing's happening. Those vibrations are actually special phonons, they're cantilever modes. Why doesn't this guy pop off and go into the solution? Why doesn't he join the fluid? He is 3 microns from his nearest neighbor. They're not close. They're in no sense touching. That gap was 10 minutes. This is 10 minutes later. So again, and then another 10 minutes later after that. These are faceted crystals. And as you can tell from the fluid around them, they're nowhere near their equilibrium state. Their equilibrium state is a dilute fluid, as you saw in the beginning, to which they will eventually return. But the point is, they're having a whole hell of a hard time getting there. Sorry about the profanity.
You're not on the web, I've said the same.
Sorry.
This is the first video where we saw things melting that were posted to the wall now?
The difference is that we reduce the ionic strength. So the original, we think the ionic strength in the first video was about 5 × 10⁻⁶ molar. That's contributions from protons, hydroxyl groups, sodium from the glass, carbonate ions from carbon dioxide. Now, after washing over ion exchange resin, we know that our base ionic strength in our cell is about 5 × 10⁻⁷ molar, and we estimate that we must be cruising around 1 micromolar here or better.
So what is the Debye length detection?
The Debye length should be about 300 nanometers.
Still. So it's still short.
Well, the longest you can get in absolutely pure water is 1 micron.
Yeah, but 1 micron would be relevant to them sticking together, wouldn't it?
It would make things worse. If the screen length were 1 micron and we push the spheres together, then they really ought to want to get away from each other quite desperately. And that's in fact what we were trying to do. Thanks. Yes, perfect. That's in fact what we were trying to do. We were trying to make a Coulomb explosion. Between the balls, there were lines. Let me show you the geometry. Here's a colorized version of this picture that you've just been seeing. What you're seeing is one layer of spheres that appears dark. The second layer of spheres above that, behind that, which actually I think is the lines we're talking about. Those were the next layers.
So they seem like they're attached by something, and I just wonder how you...
Yeah, that's fantastic. It does seem that they're attached by something. And the argument I'm going to be making is that they're attached to each other by this. And now let's make the argument. The depth of that minimum was about 0.5 kT. The range was about 3 microns. The lattice constant of this crystal is about 3 microns for 1 micron sphere. You're seeing three layers in this picture. As I say, the crystal goes to 7 layers in some places.
Yeah.
You can actually back out numbers for the energetics that are holding, of the energy scales that are holding this crystal together by looking at the crystal's structure and dynamics. So here's a close-up of one of these crystals. The crystals are faceted. That alone tells you something. It tells you that they are below their thermal roughening transition. If they're below their thermal roughening transition, then there's a minimum latent heat per particle. And it turns out the minimum latent heat per particle for an FCC crystal below its roughening transition is 8 kT, period. If you have purely repulsive interactions, the maximum latent heat is 1 kT. So this is these guys are held together with a cohesive force that's 1 kT, that's an order of magnitude bigger than it could possibly be if the spheres were repelling each other. Given the number of nearest neighbor interactions, that's equivalent to 0.5 kT per nearest neighbor interaction. Now you can watch spheres bubbling around in the fluid, attach to the crystal for a little bit, bubble around, and then detach. This is again data from the experiments. And you can ask, what is the height of the barrier to attachment and detachment based on events like this, which admittedly are subjectively chosen? And again, it turns out the barrier height turns out to be something like 4 kT, which again is equivalent to 0.5 kT per nearest neighbor interaction on the surface at a lattice constant of 3 microns.
If there were only repulsive interactions, there would be no barrier to attachment and detachment. So again, this is consistent with there being a long-range attractive interaction, inconsistent with there being pure repulsion. And finally, if you look around in these fluids as the crystals melt, you'll occasionally find little clusters that have lived for as long as an hour in the suspension, bubbling around. If one guy pops off the surface of this cluster, the rest go on their merry way in seconds. So he's lived for an hour until you take his last guy, his last friend away, and then he's gone. And that's actually, you know, the official sound for that. From that, you can estimate the surface tension between the crystal and the fluid. It's a very rough estimate. And the surface tension that we get is like 5 or 6 kT per nearest neighbor separation squared. For a purely repulsive system, the maximum is 1 kT. So again, all of these things are consistent with roughly half a kT interaction, attractive interaction, at a separation of 3 microns. So we go back to the measurement against a glass wall. Because remember, these crystals are made against the glass wall. So the fact that we're seeing such things is consistent with having made these crystals against the glass wall. But what about the second layer? It's not against the glass wall, it's against the first layer. What about the fifth layer? It only sees the fourth layer. What's holding the fifth layer on? Is the fifth layer in contact with the walls? Well, it turns out the fifth layer is at about this height from the wall, where the pair interaction measurements reveal no attraction. So by the time you get to the fifth layer of crystal, you're so far from the wall that you don't see it anymore. So the wall isn't holding the fifth layer together. And yet the fifth layer is held together. So the argument is that the fifth layer is held on by the fourth layer, by the third layer, and so on down until the first layer is held together by the glass. The separation of the first layer from the glass is just about the same as the separation of the first layer from the second layer. So this is suggesting that whatever the glass is doing, the spheres themselves can do a similar thing. You don't need the glass walls to get this kind of many-body cohesion. So there are three things I can do, one of which is to thank you, the other of which is to tell you what I think is actually going on, but I'm not a theorist, so that's really dangerous. I can also show you some new data, but I don't really have time. I'll tell you about it if you want. What I think I'll actually close with is this. This is actually done by an undergraduate, Elizabeth Barron, in my group. She had the suspensions with voids in them that I started you out with as evidence for attractive interaction. And what she did was she took an optical tweezer and grabbed the sphere near the void, and I told her, please put the sphere in the void and tell me what the sphere does. And so she took the optical tweezer and tried to put it in the void, and instead of succeeding, what she did was she moved the void. Don't you wish you could do that? Actually, move the void. And so as you move the tweezer, the voids move. What you can do is you can take the voids and push them together and merge them into a big void, and then you can take the big void and shear it apart with the tweezers back into its component voids. You can play with these voids at will. The spheres flow around the void, so the result is that there's something in there. It's negatively charged, the spheres don't like it. It's invisible, so it's probably a polyelectrolyte, and they don't merge, which is consistent with them being polyelectrolyte. We thought, oh good, it's DNA. You know, we're biophysicists at last. But it turns out what it really was improperly pure epoxy. And I'm not saying that that's what everybody sees when they see voids, because I do believe that the attractive interactions we've shown will influence the phase behavior of suspensions. They don't have their origin in linear theories. It's becoming increasingly clear that they, well, it's becoming disturbingly clear that they may not find their origin in nonlinear Poisson-Boltzmann theory either. I don't share Michael Fisher's distaste for integral equations because I don't share his understanding of them. But I think we are approaching the point where we do have a hope of understanding where these attractions come from. With that, I'll close and once again put up the people whose work this was and point you to our webpage. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
That's a fantastic question. So we've got this, what we found is if you drive spheres electrophoretically in one direction, I'm doing that right now. So if you drive the spheres electrophoretically in one direction, there's a tendency for them to move in the normal direction by this effect that we don't understand, and it seems to be a size-specific mechanism. So the question is, can we use that to separate out things of different sizes, for example, proteins? My best answer, the most honest answer is, for colloidal spheres, the answer is yes, we can. For things that are smaller than that, I have no idea because, as I say, the length scales do seem to be important, and you will run into some fundamental numbers like the capillary length of water, which is bound to come into a correct explanation of the effect. How that will influence what happens at a good, I don't know.
Yes, sir.
I just have a kind of curiosity. I mean, you showed a slide where you had it fitted to the kind of cross the instrument and half the dollar.
That's right, yeah.
What we are saying is this, and to look up through the length law of money, the 1/r². Can you try that?
Oh, absolutely. The question is, why did I choose this functional form? I would say I pulled it out of my hat or other places. And other functional forms would work. The reason I chose this was to emphasize that the attraction is longer range than the repulsion. But since I don't understand its origin, really, I don't know what the best functional form, what the appropriate functional form to fit it with is.
Yeah, the reason for my question is, you could do, like, for example, the Bar-Hookel.
The question of what is the sign of the interaction is sort of one of the points of the talk.
If you backtrack to George Stell's talk,
that's right.
And then he was asked, he was specifically pointing out, and I think we'd agree on that, that if I start with the RPM, it phase separates. Okay.
That's right.
Okay, and it phase separates by itself, and there's a surface tension between the two phases. And then he was asked, well, supposing I make them much bigger and much smaller, maybe he wouldn't believe the specific theories, but he still believes there'll be some phase separation. So if I have phase separation, even in the fluid phase, and I cool it down, I would expect to find a phase-separated crystal. And as my understanding there is still that it's cooperative in the sense that you half implied that there is screening charge around, which holds things electrically neutral, and that you gain in free energy, i.e. you lower the free energy, by sharing the screening charge as in the picture you have there. So I wasn't sure whether you were saying, well, that's wrong, or you know it's wrong, but that seems to be what drives the phase separation in the simple situation, near the restricted primitive model. Now, this is far away from it,
but I
don't quite see why the similar mechanism is not reasonable.
This is, I would say, well, certainly for me, it's a subtle question. And I think the unsubtle answer, which may be incorrect, I may have missed the point, is that the effective attraction that implies is, again, a short range, of short range. It has to do with the discrete structure of the electrolyte. But that's not to say that,
it has to do with the discrete structure of one component of the electrolyte, namely the columns.
That's right. But I think in order to generate the attraction, but through this mechanism, and again, I defer to superior knowledge, I think that you would also need to take into account in this mechanism the discrete size of the simple ions. If I'm wrong, if I'm wrong, then that's fabulous for two reasons. Because one of the theories that George Stell referred to, which I'm desperately searching for and won't find, is the Kirkwood theory for liquid structure, which was applied by Roger Hastings to this problem. He drew an unfortunate conclusion at the end of his paper, which is why it's not cited very often anymore, but I think. But I think it's right on the mark, and it's actually our working, this Kirkwood version of liquid structure theory is now our working hypothesis for how these systems behave.
Well, certainly within the primitive models of hard spheres, you can consider the limit of a one sphere going to zero size, and in the formulae I showed yesterday, I should have considered that limit too. It works out in perfectly the world is fine. And although George and I would both agree we wouldn't believe the simple theories quantitatively down to those extremes, I find it hard to believe that the similar mechanisms of phase separation wouldn't be present.
I think what I'm saying is I agree.
Okay.
But the length scale, Michael, if I recall, that length scale occurs on the level of zero length, not on the level of micron.
Well, that's why I was asking him what the bi-length was under these situations. And the point is, this, as I understood it, this was very well watched, and therefore the divide length was pretty long, and then it becomes a more quantitative question. Given the geometry, given the divide length, am I in a regime where that's quantitatively reasonable? But the point is, it is a many-body effect in the sense that you're comparing the free energy of a crystal with the free energy of the phase, and that doesn't necessarily come down to what the individual pairs do.
Now, actually, just to clarify that a little more, the experiments I showed you were selected because they happened to come out of my lab. There are a number of other fabulous experiments that have been done, particularly in Japan, where people have seen effects that could be consistent with what we would call attractive interactions, what's probably better referred to as many-body cohesions, in fluid samples. For example, there are observations of voids that are probably real. Not the result of Schmutz. So the particular, the only clarification I make is that the particular phase, the structural phase that the colleague makes, doesn't seem to be important in as you would imagine in making
Okay. Just a minute.
Maybe
that's
it.
Thank
you.
Thank
you.
That's correct. We've made neutral surfaces, but we've tried, by terminating with octadecyl silanes of various kinds. That kills the effect. We can no longer drive the spheres to the wall. So the charge on the wall is important. It sets up part of the Poisson flow. Oppositely charged walls, we actually tried also, but rapidly stopped trying because the spheres just stuck to the walls. It doesn't mean that they always will. It just means that they have, and after you've taken a month or two to clean your cell up and have the spheres stick, that's kind of disappointing for a graduate student there. For us right now, our greener pastures.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did you try something bivalent?
Yes, we've looked at interactions of particles in the presence of bivalent counterions. We see strong attractions. We actually see aggregation.
Even for the isolated geometry?
Yeah, I mean, and that, I didn't emphasize that, and I should have. Polyvalent counterions are a whole different ballgame. What I was trying to show today is that even monovalent counterions lead to behavior that's not captured in linear theory.
From the walls, polyvalent ions.
The question is, do the walls leak polyvalent ions? The walls are made of sodalite glass. They leak sodium principally, with some, there is not a big concentration of divalent ions in sodalite glass to be had. Oh yeah, what I think is going to end up being the right answer is liquid structure theory due to Kirkwood, as interpreted for me by this paper of Hastings and J10 Fizz in 1978.
Well, not that
I didn't know. I can tell you the gist of it. And I wish I could find my transparencies, because then I could show you the meat of it too. The gist of it is the following: if you look at the correlations between the macro ions and the counter ions, linear theory tells you that the counter ions fall off monotonically with distance from the macro ions, and that's also the result of, say, an Ornstein-Zeilinger-style liquid structure theory with MSA closure or with hyphenated chain closure, I believe also, although hyphenated chain may lead to something more rich than that. The Kirkwood theory tells you that the correlations needn't fall off monotonically with distance. But as you pass through a critical point, which is set by the size of the particles and the concentration of ions, you can have oscillatory decays of correlations. Those oscillations correspond to the formation of space charges, excess cationic, deficit of cations in a certain region, like the ones that I think are consistent with the sort of fits of the attraction, the idea that there's some excess charge.
But those were discussed by George Stell, and they show up in any theory that's a little more sophisticated. And that's why I stressed when I talked about the Debye-Huckel theory that although the e to the minus kappa r is very fashionable,
it's only the
short distance. And then if you say what are the correlation functions, there are various ways of attacking it, you don't need an integral equation, you will always come up, and again, as George said, this was shown forcibly by Stillinger, that there must be charge oscillations, and they set in at somewhere around the sort of kappa a of equal to 1. So the question that you asked is crucial here. Well, I mean, what is the kappa, and are we inside that sort of domain, or are we too far outside it?
And the answer is, so far, the answer to that question is, are we in the right domain to see the charge oscillations?
Yes.
The answer is, so far, yes. When we see the attraction, when we see the cohesive crystals, we're on the proper side of the critical point. We should see the oscillatory decay of correlations. The real test is going to be to use the holographic optical tweezers to construct little clusters in free space and ask, are those little clusters self-cohesive or do they fall apart as a function of controlled ionic strength running through the prediction that comes out of either the Kerfluth theory or something better.